mission. To hear more, go to www.ncra.ca/resonating.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, back to Amandla, your weekly news show with news and analysis about the continent of Africa. Today, we are doing a rebroadcast because our friend and comrade, Stéphane Christophe from Free City Radio, has pulled together a panel with the help of Alternatives, the activist organization that dates back actually to the anti-apartheid era. And they have a wonderful panel of people from Kenya who are talking about activism in the time of COVID in Kenya. And one of those panelists is our friend and contributor, Zara Mulud. So we're very excited to have the chance to broadcast this for you. It's from Free City Radio, which was played this afternoon on their program. And we're rebroadcasting it tonight. So stay tuned to Amandla.
Good day, everybody. Thank you for joining our panel today. This is part of a series hosted by Alternatives in collaboration with CKUT Radio in Montreal, and particularly the program Free City Radio, which is a program that explores the intersections of activism and the arts, but also tries to highlight voices from around the world. The webinar today is looking at the ways that activists are responding to the pandemic crisis in Kenya, but also looking at the broader context of systemic injustice in Kenya. So for a number of years, there's been various important campaigns around police brutality and repression that has been targeting urban poor communities in Nairobi, but also in other cities. This has been amplified in some ways in the context of the pandemic and the state enforcement mechanisms of restrictions that have impacted in a unbalanced way urban poor communities. There's been a number of people who've lost their lives within this context of police violence. There's a lot of critiques and campaigns around this point. There's also campaigning around the corruption of state PPE and pandemic related funds. And then beyond just looking at this in the context of corruption, it's about looking at the ways that corruption enforces economic inequalities within Kenya. This is a system we see mirrored in other contexts globally. So looking beyond the simplistic corruption narrative to understand the ways that corruption is actually part of social injustice. And then finally, we're trying to look at the context of Kenya within a global scenario. So looking at the ways that corporations have hopped on to the pandemic crisis to deepen profits. We see that with huge companies like Amazon, of course, on a global level, but we also see that happening with big tech in the world of food and agriculture. Kenya and East Africa, of course, has many regions that are deeply agricultural. There has been campaigns for autonomy within agricultural communities. But within the context of the pandemic, there has been the deepening of digital farming. This is an issue that ETC Group, which is represented here today, has looked at in a broader global sense. And I think it points to the issues of the ways that corporations have jumped on the pandemic to deepen control within food distribution networks, within agricultural sector, within transportation and technology. So thank you so much to the panelists and of course to CKUT Radio for broadcasting this conversation. I'm Stéphane Christophe in Montreal. We have three panelists who will be joining us. Gashiki, who's the coordinator of the Mahatari Social Justice Center in Nairobi, will hear from investigative journalist, researcher, and documentary filmmaker Zahra Mulu, who also works with ETC Group, and Suhail Omar, who's a Kenyan-based researcher, and his interest focuses on theorizing policing, surveillance, and militarism within the context of Kenya. I will read a full introduction for everybody before they speak. Thank you again to everybody for your presence today and joining this conversation. I will first give the floor to Gashiki in Nairobi. Thank you so much for being here, and please please share with us how the Mahatari Social Justice Center has been addressing the pandemic crisis. I know that recently you have organized an exhibition, for example, looking at the cases of state-related violence and repression. Maybe we can start there.
Hello, I hope you can hear me, comrades. I thank you very much, Stephanie. This is a very great, important opportunity for us in Mathare and a community organizer, social justice activist movement in Kenya to amplify our struggle within the alternative movement, social movement, and also really appreciate the CKUT Radio hosting us and giving us this opportunity together before. This is very, very important. And as you know, COVID-19 hit us last year after what's happened in China, then it spread all over the world last year, March. But before this COVID-19, we had many, many other pandemic that had come through neoliberal policies for the last 30 years that had hit us in a difficult way, like a crisis in healthcare. There is a crisis issue of unemployment also was still there. Corruption was still also grappling with many other struggle. Mathare Social Justice Center, which is a community-based organization registered here in Nairobi, we were still struggling with police brutality. So when COVID came in, it found a state that was very weak in terms of providing people with the basic needs. So there was no access of clean water in Mathare. And you know, when COVID came in, the idea was that people must wash up their hands, must stay clean. We have a major crisis of unemployment, people in informal settlements. They could not, they are in the informal economy. So they work from hands to mouth. They go to do the small work in the industries. Some also go to do washing of a laundry within the informal, within some middle-class areas. So you see, it came in when we had already major other pandemics of crisis of healthcare, education, job. So when it came in and it hit the poor in a very bad situation because there was a lockdown, and this lockdown, it was not solving the problem. It's not like putting people in a prison where there's no food, there's no water, there's no healthcare. And the people started resisting again these lockdowns. So what's happened is that police reacted through violence. And that's how we started documenting cases of extrajudicial killing. You could find that people, and one case was being reported at the days related to COVID. So you would see systematically police continued enforcing curfew through violence, illegal detention, and attacking people during the night. Some people were homeless, some became victim of police brutality, they died. And this is how Kenyan people, especially the poor and the working class, confronted the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020, all the way up to now, the end of the year, and now this year. Things have not changed. As you know, informal economy, when it closed, millions of people lost their job, poverty, crisis. So there's a lot of crisis shaping up now, even now, of violence, sexual and gender-based violence. So this has been a very major challenge. And I'm sure Suhail, through mutual aid also, they did a lot of great work in supporting some of our comrades, especially community human rights defenders, with food through mutual aids, small packages that would be spread to different community-based organizations. Those were the first, some of those response, but because the government could not provide people with the basics. So people really starved, and then crime became high, violence. So I remember those times we used to get some small support from comrades like Swell through mutual aid support. But majorly, our responders, like Mathare Social Justice Center, was documenting these cases through circumstances that people are being killed, being illegal detained. And in the first 3 months, we had a documented number of cases. We issued statements showing the manifestation of this police brutality. A dozen of young people were killed. Some were shot in their balcony. There's one case that was reported in just within our community called Kiamaiko. A young man of 13 years old was shot dead. We were standing in their balcony. Somebody else was killed. He was homeless in Mathare. He was found by police, was clobbered. We documented those cases. There was an increase in a forced disappearance. Within our community, we also lost 3 activists. Even today, we have never found them. They just disappeared, and we have never found them. So there was an increase also of an enforced disappearance, extrajudicial killing. And this is what Mathare Social Justice Center started responding by documenting and sharing this information with the different human rights organizations and platforms. And then it had an impact that also other social justice centers started coming in and documenting. This is how we responded, majorly because in terms of social services and solution, we could not manage to do basic needs, but in terms of documenting and showing the impact of the limitation of a neocolonial state in Kenya and how it responded with the violence, that we were able to show, and our case human rights reports were covered different platforms, even the international media and local media. And this also gave a strong message about how the Kenyan state was dealing with the issue of COVID-19. But you know, this is it's connected with the history of the problem of corruption also. We had a major problem about the protection equipment that most of the frontline defenders, like doctors, nurses, had a major crisis. As you know, there was a major corruption also with the procurement of this equipment. So majority of them, the workers in the health sector, started protesting, organizing a strike. So also that caused a lot of people also to lose their life. So that has never even been resolved. They were paid poorly. They were working many hours without a payment. So corruption had a major impact in the COVID-19 response. So, and this also made sure that millions of people were taken back to poverty. And also in the recently, many thousand, can say many people also have died because a crisis of healthcare, corruption also, health providers, they are not able to get to the jobs, to their works because they are being paid poorly. So this crisis is still with us even today. And it has contributed a lot of problems, as I say, sexual and gender-based violence. A lot of poor people now, everywhere you can see, no access to basics. Major crisis also came up with the close of the schools, both primary schools, secondary schools, university. Then after that, there was a crisis of teenage pregnant young people were teenage mothers. You find many young people are exposed to sexual violations. And you see this is another major crisis. They were nowhere they could get help. So this problem is still recurring. And we have a huge population of young women who are victimized during COVID-19 and because they spend a lot of time when they were not schools. There is a now major crisis of the mental health. Many young people, even related to us in our social justice center, are committing suicide because of depression, mental illness. So this problem is has become a big problem, bigger crisis, and it's because also the economic meltdown. As you know, Kenya government started copying solutions from China, Europe, North America, developed countries. That you created a lockdown, you don't have water, you don't have a modern economy, so you have informal economy. So what happened? Those economy collapse, tourism industry collapse, and this is a major crisis. But what we have done, we have responded with saying that these are bigger crises also of capitalism and neoliberal policy that our government has followed in the last 30 years. And this is our struggle. We have a widespread social justice center movement that is shaping up. This crisis also have shown poor people, they are alone. They have to think the alternative economic model that can provide people with social justice, basics, restore dignity back to our people. I think part of the biggest problem that we have faced is because we didn't have a strong social force to challenge the crisis. Our trade union movement every week, they were co-opted. So majority of the work that was done in articulating this crisis in a different way were human rights activists, social justice activists like ourselves, Mathare Social Justice Center. It is now why we are consolidating the game that we've been and drinking with other progressive voices in terms of building a formidable grassroots social justice movement. Continue with the struggle in fighting against social injustices that has sharpened with the COVID-19 as in many other African countries. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your breakdown about your work at the Mathare Social Justice Center in Nairobi. I look forward to hearing more of your perspectives as this event unfolds. Just quickly, I would encourage people to look up Geshiki's work, who, as a writer, as a researcher, has worked on videos for the Review of African Political Economy, also has written for Africa as a Country, and Pambazuka News. And yeah, so you can look on the event page for the bio. And I think that in terms of understanding sort of the systemic issues, I really appreciated how, Geshiki, you highlighted that there was an existing crisis. And I think that on a global scale, in the context of neoliberalism, we've seen the ways that the pandemic has mounted the severity of the impacts of COVID-19 on a global scale in regards to existing economic inequality and neo-colonial models around the world. Corporations have really moved to benefit from this context. And I think that, unfortunately, because of the crisis, a lot of people have been really focused on the fact that COVID-19 has impacted the entire world. And one, you know, important point of conversation that we don't see, for example, in the mainstream media in Canada as much as is needed, is the ways that the pandemic has disproportionately impacted the South. And in the context of a city like Nairobi, in the context of Kenya, obviously the pandemic has had disproportionate impacts on urban poor areas that we heard about. On the topic of corporations and the ways that they have used the pandemic to extend their influence, there has been a move from big tech companies, some operating in Kenya, but also more broadly within East Africa and globally, around the push to control more deeply food and agricultural markets through digital farming. This, of course, lessens the autonomy of agricultural communities, and it increases urbanization. This is an issue that ETC Group has worked on a global scale. And researcher, documentary filmmaker Zahra Mulu has been part of that process and really helped shape the also event today in terms of suggesting panelists. So thank you, Zahra, for that. I'll leave it to you to share a bit about the research that you've been doing.
Sure. Thank you, Stefan. Thanks very much. And thank you to Alternative also. I'll say a few words about some of the work that Etcetera Group has been doing. Just quickly, Etcetera is an international organization, and we monitor the impact of emerging technologies and corporate strategies on biodiversity, agriculture, and human rights. And so a lot of the work we've been looking at is on big agricultural, agri-tech companies. One of the things you notice with this pandemic is that there has been, efforts to accelerate the move towards digital agriculture across the world and including in the Global South. So at Etcetera Group, we've been looking at trends in digital agriculture quite recently. So I'll give you a bit of just context and information about digital agriculture to understand why it's a problem and why it's a threat during this time of a pandemic where so much is becoming digital. So one of the things we've noticed is that, over the last years, you see that food corporations have been getting bigger and bigger and fewer and fewer. And that's not something new. I mean, you have four corporations that control over half of the commercial seed market. You have four corporations that control about two thirds of the agrochemical market. And those corporations are Bayer, which bought up Monsanto, Corteva Agriscience, Syngenta, and BASF. And so, as we go forward, there's existing trends in terms of what's been happening even before the pandemic. And so you'll see more and more mergers and corporations becoming more powerful and consolidated. But what's becoming a bit newer is that the same sort of agricultural giants that grew very rich and powerful from the industrial food system are now combining their power with data giants. And as you know, data is a very valuable resource. And so the more it's hoarded and aggregated, the more it increases in value. And so now in Kenya and also elsewhere, you see digital farming being presented to farmers as if they have digital tools, farmers can realize greater efficiency, they can have greater return on their investments, and it's good for them. And so farmers are getting this message that they're receiving services for free from agricultural companies like, for example, Bayer. But in fact, what's happening is that data is being mined by these companies and used. And so I'll give an example. So for example, there's a digital platform called Climate Field View that was developed by the Climate Corporation, which is a Silicon Valley startup that was bought up by Monsanto in 2013 for almost $1 billion. And so a lot of people were wondering, why is Monsanto buying up this platform on weather technology? But in fact, what they said is that in a few years, Monsanto said, we'll become a technology information company. And so now this platform, Climate Field View, basically provides information about the state of your soil if you're a farmer. And they have a feature called field capture. So you can take pictures of the diseases on your crops, and then you put it into Field View, and it goes off and searches it against thousands of pictures from Bayer and suggests which Bayer products and herbicides you can use for the problem on your farm. And so that's one example of a platform that's being used for agriculture. And there's a lot of others that are owned by the big agricultural giants like John Deere, Corteva. And so what they're doing is they're extracting data on seeds, soils, on fertilizer, on weather, and they input this into their AI systems, their artificial intelligence systems. And then they suggest based on that what farmers should farm, when they should farm, what products they should use. And these services are basically presented as free, but actually they're using the data from farmers for their own projects. So one example also is Azure Farmbeat. So in Africa, you might have heard that Bill Gates has poured a lot of money into trying to get small farmers in the South to adopt pesticides, advanced seeds, and all these products that are sold by the world's largest agribusiness corporations through projects and institutions like AGRA, which is the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa. but adoption rates for these technologies were quite remained low. So Gates is now trying to move into digital agriculture. And so in 2020, Microsoft and the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa began to expand this digital platform called Azure Farm Beats with this app called KuzaBot. And the app provides farmers with advice on WhatsApp and SMS, also including which inputs to use from which companies. But they're also partnered with this US climate, this startup called Climate Edge. And what they're doing is they're taking data from small farmers that are supplied by NGOs and companies and researchers, and then selling that to insurance companies, pesticide dealers, food companies. So you're seeing that all that data is actually being sold on. And then in Kenya, an interesting example of digital services in agriculture is Arifu, which is it's a chatbot advisory service, and it's partnered with Syngenta, which is a seeds and pesticides company. And so what Arifu is doing in Kenya is basically creating a demand for seeds from Syngenta. And it's also part of this larger platform called DigiFarm, which is operated by Safaricom. And if you're in Kenya, you know that Safaricom is the biggest mobile money operator. And so DigiFarm is providing millions of farmers in Kenya with chatbot services, but also selling them inputs and crop insurance, offering them loans, selling their produce. And basically, they're saying that they're providing financial services to rural people who wouldn't be able to access them otherwise. But farmers are being locked into the system where they have to buy inputs that are sold on credit. They have to follow the advice of the chatbot app and qualify for crop insurance. They have to sell their crops to the company. So it's all very, they're kind of locked into the system. The organization Grain, which also works on agriculture and has done really good work on this, basically calls this contract farming on a mass scale. And then you have other developments in digital agriculture, for example, the move towards automation. Agriculture is going to be the second largest use of drones for getting visuals from farms, but also for applying pesticides. You're going to have an uptake of robots, including mini robots that will be weeding and picking pests, dealing with pests. So digital farming is something where all these things are going to come together: drones, the extraction of data, robots. And so it sort of strips all the human relations with the soil, with plants. And so there's a lot of issues with this, which I can go into, or we can go into it later. And so there's a lot of problems with digital farming, and the pandemic is sort of being used as a way to say we need digital farming in the global south. And on the other hand, you have to remember that industrial agriculture actually does increase the risk of pandemics. And we've seen that there have been other pandemics that have come about. It's a very, very unsustainable and unsanitary system. So that's something to keep in mind when you think about the pandemic and agriculture. So I don't know if I've spoken too long or if I should go into some of the impacts of digitalization, or I can stop here. Or
that would be great. I think it would be great to hear a bit more of that context. Thank you, Zahra.
Sure. Okay. So So basically, for farmers, a lot of this, the reason why this is a problem is for several reasons. One is that they don't have a lot of control or ownership. So for example, the company John Deere sells tractors to farmers, but it forbids farmers to repair their equipment. So if you buy a tractor from John Deere and they have a way of extracting data from the tractor, you also have to sign up for conditions regarding your data. So you can't do repairs on your own tractor if you're a farmer. And so that raises a lot of concerns over losing control over your own farming equipment. The other issue with it is that it could push up the cost of land. So in 2020, the Bayer Field View app, which I mentioned before, had an agreement with a company called Tillable, which calls themselves the Airbnb of farmland. And so they're building a whole database of farmland, and they want to be able to rent out that farmland to farmers. So basically, Tillable takes the data from Bayer's FieldView app and goes to farmers and makes offers on land that are actually higher than what the farmers are already paying. So there you see how data is now being used to actually works very much against farmers and their access to land. Other things is, you know, I mentioned that data was being sold on, data from small farms is being sold. But also, you know, the value, the data is very valuable, and sometimes it's not really clear who it's being shared with or sold to. I also mentioned the issue of lock-ins. So, you know, if you have like a Bayer field view system, they will promise you certain returns as a farmer. Like if you use our prescriptions, you can sell your corn at a certain rate. But if you don't, the company will make up the difference. So if you sell your produce for more, the more than half of the difference will go to the company. So what's happened is that the farmers actually given them all the data, agreed to buy their products. And so that's another issue. Another issue is, as I mentioned, the robots. You know, people in farming are already very much exploited in agricultural industries. But if you have robots, you have even less need for workers and for migrant workers. And we also see that robots might actually augment workers. So in this very weird science fiction scenario in Japan, you have workers being enhanced by robots by having their like hands to pick up things, which is actually very bad for their bodies. And then also you have examples of Amazon. So one of the industries that's been very much roboticized is Amazon's warehouses, where workers are directed as robots. They're very controlled. They're expected to work fast. And you end up having a lot of injuries. Workers have a lot of injuries. I'll mention a couple of others. There are several other points I can mention. But also you have to remember that data is energy. So when we have this idea that everything going digital is very good for climate change, it's all digital, so it's not tangible, and therefore it's good for the environment. But actually data is energy. And so all the infrastructure to bring into being digitalization is going to require a huge amount of infrastructure and electricity. And so data will actually create climate emissions, not necessarily reduce them. And you have to think of all the energy that goes into building data infrastructure, wires, cables, water, chemicals, mining. So there's that. And a lot of people say, well, why can't digital agriculture be advantageous to farmers? There must be ways in which it's useful to them. But, you know, you see that if technology is introduced within this sort of framework, it's not going to be beneficial to them. And in Kenya, for example, there's an agri-tech company called Twiga Foods that was founded by this US academic who wanted to connect small farmers to vendors and bypass the powerful cartels. So Twiga built up a whole fleet of trucks to get food from farmers outside Nairobi and then deliver them to vendors in the city. But then all of these transactions were being organized through cell phones and run on Microsoft's digital platform and cloud services. And then all these larger companies started to take interest, and Goldman Sachs took major stakes in the company. Twiga partnered with IBM. And so now Twiga is selling foods directly to consumers, and they've cut out the small vendors that they were supposed to be helping in the first place. So it's quite, you know, this is how corporations end up inserting themselves into these networks. And so it's really quite dangerous to think of how the pandemic can potentially increase the digitalization of agriculture, and think about what impact this has on small farmers. Yeah, I'll stop there.
Hi, I'm Doug Miller, and I'm just here to remind you that this is Amanda here at CKUT 90.3 FM. You're listening to a rebroadcast from a show presented by Free City Radio, produced by Stefan Christoph, an outstanding activist, who's brought together three activists from Kenya to talk about the situation facing activism and activists in Kenya during the period of COVID. So stay tuned to that show.
Thank you, Zahra, for sharing your thoughts and these tangible examples. I think, you know, if we are actively trying to think about the pandemic and how it's impacted access to democratic rights, and I use that term with hesitation, but in hearing your presentation, Zahra and Geshiki, before, about the ways the pandemic has disproportionately impacted urban poor communities. We've heard also how it's impacted agricultural communities. We can really think about the ways that international corporate activity on various fronts works to actually undercut the role of public institutions and look at the state simply as a security mechanism and open up space for corporations, especially given, you know, the persisting colonial dynamics to, in the context of East Africa, to access agricultural data or lands or markets. But then there's basically a cutting out of mechanisms of public participation within that context. And I think that, you know, when we think about like state repression and the ways that the pandemic has basically been a boon for security systems and state policing and sort of the role of the state as a police force, not as a public infrastructure that can actually address needs, whether it's around agriculture, health, housing, etc. And so I think about your work, Suhail, with the ways that you know, you have worked in the context of this crisis with, I'm sure, many others. You're a Kenyan-based researcher, and you have been looking at the toll of pandemic policing in Kenya's urban informal settlements, and how the basically pandemic has magnified violence. And I'm thinking just about how it seems like in many contexts around the world, and we heard in the last discussion around Chile, the ways that policing powers were actually increased, and also in tandem, privatization was also increased in various sectors in Chile. So I see some parallel here. But Suhail, if you could share a bit about your work, and thank you so much for also being part of the panel.
Yeah, thank you, Stefan. And thank you to Gesheke, Zahra, and all the organizers who've put their labor in putting this together. So what we've spoken about has been, we've spoken, the former panelists have spoken a lot about the issues affecting Kenya. But one thing I just want to mention is the pandemic did not expose a lot of the surveillance, militarism, and the violence and police brutality that we're seeing, but rather it just escalated it, and it was more or less a portal into proving that these things are happening. Even though we know that Kenya is a deeply settler colonial state, we need to understand that we live in very outlined zones. And through ethnographic research, you can make these assertions. So you can see areas in Mathare where one person is killed every night, with areas just adjacent to Mathare, such as Muthaiga, where people live in complete harmony with the police. So it brings you to ask the question, who are the police protecting, and what's the reason of policing in such areas? And one of the key assertions that we can make out of this is, in areas like Mathare, we see there's a lot of exclusion of public service, and there's also a lot of exclusion from the commons in terms of government services. So the police are there to act as the de facto government, the de facto state, to ensure that you're protecting yourself from police brutality, so you don't have time to insist that government reaches to you and you can access this government facilities. Because policing comes, it doesn't just mean that you have to have a policeman there pointing a gun at you. Violence through policing shows in how the housing is built. You see people living in a one by one metal shack, and this is a family of four living together. There's no access to water, there's no access to electricity. All these have to be maneuvered and worked around to access them in what is termed as illegal ways. And one of the other things, when I introduced the terminology pandemic policing, is we need to look at what's happening in Kenya and globally. We've seen as the police have been used to protect the state in terms of fighting suspected COVID infections as the key perpetrator. So one thing we need to understand is you cannot police a virus. It means you end up policing bodies. And these bodies are more or less those who are excluded from the common national infrastructure or the checkbook marks of who is Kenyan. And we need to understand one of the key things, even before the pandemic, is Kenya is a deeply settler colonial state that is learning from its proximity to empire and fascism. And we can make this more clearly now we can make these parallels. We can compare how Kenya's occupation in of Somalia's southern border is similar to what's happening in occupied Palestine. We can make the assertions of the violent policing and expansion of militarism that's happening in Kenya is similar to what's happening in Kashmir by India. And what we need to understand is that what we're seeing now is not just an expansion of militarism, policing, and surveillance. It's something that's been happening, but now that it's happening outside the commons and the urban informal settlements is when we're seeing it as issues. But for the past 63 years, for the past, since Kenya got its independence, these are things that have been happening. The police have had ultimate power to act as they will. So they have been the de facto government and the law. So there's no part for constitutionalism, democracy, or impartiality when it comes to dealing with people living in the urban informal settlements or the slums. It shows that if a police detains you, it's not illegal detention. It's they've detained you because they are the law, they are the judge, they are the lawyer. And just to quickly speak about to contextualize everything that I've been saying, since 2007, we've documented Kenyan Civil Society has documented about 834 police killings, and it's termed as extrajudicial killings. But regardless, it shouldn't be termed as extrajudicial killings; it should be police killings. So we understand the impact that has that this form of violence has. And we've had about, in 2021 alone, we've had about 105 killings. In 2020, we saw a rise where there was over 200 documented killings. And these are just documented killings. We know there's more killings that are happening that are not documented and don't get airtime on mainstream media. And even while we look at it, there's also clandestine state-sanctioned blocs such as the Anti-Terror Police Unit, which are funded, armed, and trained by states like the US and Israel, and they are actively working within Kenya to subject the Cushitic communities. And through the pandemic, we've seen this. Early in the pandemic, we saw the instance of the Chitswa family, where we saw the anti-terror police raid a home and killed mother, father, two children, and a fetus and termed it as and justified it as collateral damage. Till today, there's no justice for this family. There's no talk about this family on mainstream media. So once we look at the issues of the state, yes, the state is complicit, but what other mechanisms around it ensure that this complicitness is protected? And one of the key issues, one of the key perpetrators is the media, because the media doesn't give attention to all these issues that have been brought out to light, and they only remain in the conundrum of academic circles or intellectual circles or authors or active citizens who seek to talk about these issues. And through the pandemic, we've seen a lot of privatization happening and entrenching of violence. And for one thing, since the curfew was put in place, which was about 1 year, May 27th. Since then, we've seen the invocation of the Public Health Act, which has just seen, rather than protecting the citizens, it's seen giving more power to state apparatus, which is the police, the military, and all these capacities that are just furthering the subjection and subjugation of the Kenyan citizens, especially in urban informal settlements. In terms of curfew and the inter-county lockdowns that were put in place, we saw an upsurge in not just killings by the police, but also increased police brutality, where all these instances were recorded and documented by citizens, where civilians are being abused and killed in cases such as Yasin Moyo's case and many others, and many of the other faceless and nameless victims that we know of. But what mechanisms of justice can we seek when more than 100 people have died, yet the state has refused to implicate itself, and which we know the judiciary will never implicate the state, because once the judiciary implicates the state, it's self-implication and will rupture the preservation of the state and the constitution. In terms of, sorry, I'm just going through my notes, but I've just shout out to, I do have a paper, I am working on a paper on pandemic policing, which I will share with everyone, share with Stefan and the team, who will share it with everyone who's interested in reading more about it. But in terms of privatization, once we look at it, one of the key combats of the virus was washing your hands frequently. We need to ask ourselves, in terms of urban informal settlements, who has access to something as similar as water? You have to, everything that happens in the urban informal settlements is termed as illegal because there's no way you can legally access these mechanisms because you can't afford it. And it's structural disorientation so that they cannot afford this and remain in this marginalized commons so that the elite can extract labor and exploit them continuously without being implicated. So one of the key things is, for example, a slum in South B, the Mukuru Kwanjenga slums residents, where the elite within the area have taken over the national pipeline systems and they've formed individual cartels where they do sell water to the people living in this urban informal settlement. And so now you have to battle government, you have to battle the de facto managers of state capacities, which is water, who are controlling the pipelines. And then now you have to ensure that you have to create and execute and ensure that the piping to your home, you cater for it. So if you look at the exclusions, it's very manufactured. These are things we can allude in simple ways. It's just an issue of a practice of care by the state, which we have seen none of since the pandemic started. And in terms of capacity, we can look at it even in the terms of, we've seen in the past 1 year and few months that COVID has been present in our lives, we've seen increased demolitions and forced evictions in Kenya's urban informal settlements, where the state goes in with tractors in the middle of the night and starts destroying people's homes, whether you're in them or out, they don't care, but homes are being demolished, people are being forcefully evicted in terms of development. And it brings us back to the question of development at what cost? Because these people are being left houseless, their houses are being demolished, and everything they have is being destroyed just so roads to make the city more accessible for the elite and the political class can be made. And so Kenya is being seen as a hub of development, but development in itself is violence if this development comes at the cost of destruction, violations, and increased institutionalized and systemic violence. So what we're seeing at the moment is just building up on what Sahra has said on digitalization, but we need to also look at development as how she had explained digitalization. We're living in a world where I think data is the second most expensive asset you can use money to buy, and that's after oil. So we're seeing a world where in as much as states are building physical walls to exclude the poor people and those who are not human enough to be citizens of the state, so they have to be excluded. So they do build walls around the borders, around the little escapades and the little classed areas. You see that we're also building digital walls. We're ensuring that there's a lot of infiltration into our private and personal online footprints, where we don't have control of what we put out anymore. So we have to be very careful about what happens. And one of the key examples is what happened a few days ago when Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp were all down. We all were globally were living in a state of panic, anxiety, and fear that if these systems don't come back up, what happens to our lives? And knowing that people living in urban informal settlements focus on these platforms of social media to document police, state-sanctioned police violence, police killings, and this structural violence that they are in proximity to, it was one night where everyone wasn't sure what's going to happen tomorrow morning. Are we going to wake up as Kenyans and see what we saw 8 years ago, where Kushite communities are being rounded up and being put in one of the largest open-air prisons, which was once a stadium, and when we woke up the next day, it was a prison? Or will we see massacres, people being killed in the urban informal settlements, or houses demolished? And not just that, but even for a lot of people living in the global south, speaking generally, is these are the platforms we use to communicate with our families. So building this digital walls ensures that one person or one platform owner has the power to ensure what information is coming out and what information is coming in and how we can communicate with each other. And as I finish up, the pandemic has been one of the key, I don't know if it was a portal to the expansion of militarism, surveillance, and increased infiltration of the executive arm of government and the police into all aspects of our lives, because globally we saw that police killings and police violence was in itself also a pandemic, because from Palestine to the US to Uganda to South Africa, we can mention names on names on names of people who've been killed or abused by the police. And this brings us back to on the issue of surveillance. Even with the vaccine rollout, in as much as we're seeing the international barriers to accessing vaccines, from the TRIPS waiver to the global North hegemony to what capitalism is showing us today, which is the institutionalization of the ideology, which everyone praises so much in comparison to any other ideology, we're seeing that we can't access the vaccines without giving out all our data. In Kenya, you can't access a vaccine without an identification card. And while filling the information, you have to mention your religion, your age, where you live. So it's a lot of information that's being given out. You don't know how the information is being protected. You don't know who will have access to this information. And we know our governments are complicit. We are afraid that one day we'll wake up and our data has been sold, because we live in the age where governments aren't afraid of the citizens anymore, and they do as they wish. So the highest bidder can access all our information and data at the snap of a finger. And also the vaccine question has also increased a lot of dependency on the global south. And also we're getting these vaccines for free with bilateral agreements, which is a good thing, but the clandestine nature of the agreements that global south countries are signing with the global north also bring up the issue of debt trap diplomacy, because we don't know what is being given in exchange and the terms of and conditions of this contract. So once we see, are we going to see increased global north infiltration within our countries once the pandemic is over, because we don't know what has been signed by our states. And I think I'm going to stop there, but just before I finish, one of the key things that clearly puts out the exclusion of the commons and the inaccessibility of urban informal settlements is the elections and campaign period. In Kenya, we're just about to get to the 2022 elections, the general elections, from electable positions in government. And during this time of campaigning, we see that our leaders have access to come into these areas, provide food, shelter, clothing, emergency aid, food aid, everything. But for the next 5 years, there's always excuses. It can be from access to incapabilities. There's all sorts of barriers. But what if they do want votes, they do find ways to get into these areas. So the issue is just like, as I said, we're living in a deeply, deeply, deeply settler colonial state. And one of the key agendas of Kenya's state is to exclude the commons and push them out of the city or push them out of the country, in as much because we know we're living in a very Islamophobic, anti-migrant, all the fascist textbook check marks, you can see them in Kenya. So I think all the researchers and everyone who's just spoken knows so well that one of the key studies of post-colonialism should be Kenya as a state in itself, from government to the least and the most excluded communities. And I think I'll end there.
Thank you so much, Suhail, for your reflections. The last point, if you could all maybe share just for 1 or 2 minutes, if you feel up to it, just the importance of sort of transnational activist networks in sharing this information, but also the idea that states are not monoliths, and the fact that these points can be exposed. If we think about the ways that, you know, the Matari Social Justice Center has exposed police violence in Kenya, if we think about the ways that the People's Vaccine Campaign that you were involved in, Suhail, did expose the lack of democratic access to vaccines earlier on, and then also stepped up in ways that the state wasn't stepping up in informal communities, urban poor communities. And Zahra, you talked about the ways that activists and research-based organizations, etc. group, have actually given substance to understand the ways that data-driven corporatization of agriculture in Kenya and East Africa and beyond is happening. So the role of activists to share these things, why is it important? Floor is open. Thank you.
Yeah, first, it's very, very inspiring to hear from Zahra and Suhel about militarization, surveillance, and how the state is being used now to control the people after many years and COVID-19 making them poor. And now the state, they have no solutions. Very powerful. I think I've seen some comment there that the research on it is on the ET on a digital farming. As more people think about how to come out from this crisis, the corporation, the capitalist company, big tech company, they are deepening inequality, appropriating spaces and resources and land where people would have used to resolve the crisis that was imposed by IMF and World Bank structural adjustment. And this, it's deepening inequality. Mm-hmm. But I think what you have said, Stefan, is very critical. How the transnational, the activists from international spaces like alternative movements, the rare community radio, how can we use this kind of research information in the hands of the activists like Madale Social Justice Center? Because I think as the international corporation, the tech company are using the data to deepen and continue domination against the majority and the global south and the poor. I think, and it's very important, a very powerful research around what Suhel and Zahra has done. I was not very aware about how tech company, whether Syngenta or Safaricom, a big company that are doing farming seeds, how they are creating an illusion to farmers, peasant farming, that they can use digital to resolve the problem of food crisis. And that illusion will take us back, it will take more millions of people back, poverty, hopelessness, and violence. And I think this is very important. I think we should continue with this conversation. But the idea is now that we can get this kind of information to activists, ordinary activists who have no access to modern technology, in a way of skills to do this kind of research. And I've seen the post is in the ET group. Really, really, really appreciate. But I hope we can do some of this, a small documentary in the informal settlement, and we'll know that we also do some videos in small halls in our community, so that we expose the broader issues that are affecting all people in the global crisis. And they see that the crisis of police violence, control, police brutality, extortion, killings, it's not only a Madare question, it's a global issues that is affecting people all over the world, and especially with the COVID-19 and how the private capital is appropriating resources and spaces that were for public good, and the crisis of ecological crisis that will come with the digitalization of farming, as Zahra has said, which brought major crisis that has come with COVID-19 virus from China. The way the crisis that has happened in China, mm-hmm. it's widespread also. So I think it's very important mm-hmm. that we continue linking with us.
Well, I will just say thank you to the three panelists. We are out of time. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here. Gashiki of the Madari Social Justice Center in Nairobi, Zahra Malu, an investigative journalist, researcher, and documentary filmmaker from Kenya, who works with Etcetera Group, and Suhel Omar, a Kenyan-based researcher who works on issues surrounding police and surveillance. Thank you so much to Alternatives, to Feiruz, Miriam, and Catherine for hosting, and to CKUT Community Radio. For everybody listening, thank you also to the audience for being part of this conversation. And I encourage everybody to watch this again and listen through to all the references that people have taken the time to share. Have a good day.
So that just about wraps it up for us here on Amandla. We wanted to point out that next week we're going to have a nice little feature on a great and exciting piece of news, and that is that this year's Nobel Prize winner for literature is a Zanzibari, a Tanzanian, Abdulrazak Gurna. Big surprise for, I think, everyone, including the writer himself. Very rare that African literature is recognized in this way. So we are going to take a look at him, his work, and the meaning of this prize. We'll see you next week. Stay tuned now for Jazz Euphorium.
It's Tony from Planet Giza, and you're listening to CKUT Montreal Community Radio. This is the crib right here, so shout outs to every station on here, and shout outs to you, the listener. Don't go nowhere, we'll be right back.
Le virus de la COVID-19 et ses variants se propagent toujours au Québec. En cas de symptômes d'allure grippale ou s'apparentant à ceux de la COVID-19, tels que la fièvre, la toux ou la perte du goût ou de l'odorat, ou si vous avez été en contact avec une personne infectée par le virus, il est essentiel de passer un test de dépistage et de respecter les consignes d'isolement, même si vous êtes vacciné. Le dépistage demeure un des meilleurs moyens de limiter les éclosions. Pour en savoir plus, visitez québec.ca/test-COVID-19. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
This is CKUT 90.3 FM. Also, CKD.ca for streaming audio archives and information. Good evening. This is Jazz Euphorium with Mr. Saad. We're going to begin with the instrumental version of Cantaloupe Flip Fantasia by US 3 from 1993.